This morning we truly begin the season after Pentecost. Unlike the other seasons of Advent and Christmas, the season after the Epiphany, Lent, and Easter, this season does not have an overarching theme. This is the season in which we seem to return to the main story. Right? We're here shortly after the beginning, and the story will take us to moments before that big rising action and climax we deal with in Holy Week. Now, the unobservant will breathe a sigh of relief at this point, right? Phew, finally back to normal. Certainly seems like a return to normal, I suppose. We even call it ordinary time. Now, the story we cover for about 6 months, the whole rest of the story, however, is grand and potent, full of, yes, lesser stories, but each one builds off of the one before it, right? It is full of these many short pieces like today's, which are directly dependent on the context. And in Mark, who loves frames, has framed this with two things around him. Now, the passage before it and after it really make the reader's sense of what is in it. This is the season in which we need to keep up with this story rather than relax. Right? Now, we may feel like the pressure of Lent and Easter is off, and it's time to slow down a little bit. Right? Summer vacations certainly set the wrong tone for keep at it, right? But our work now is all the more important. Now, if we're to flip in our Bibles, in the Gospel that we call Mark, to the very beginning of it, we could see that it begins with John the Baptizer and Jesus being baptized in the River Jordan. Right? And then it moves to the calling of the disciples, right? And then some healing and teaching. And then in chapter 3, it culminates with this calling of the 12, it says, to be apostles, meaning they're going to go off and do Jesus' work in the world. Now, these are the 12 that will do it, do like me. So then we come to this story, the story of a demon-possessed man and the redefining of family. And it comes after they have been called to do Jesus' work. And so chapter 3 ends with a story of Jesus, but one of Jesus showing the apostles what their work looks like. And it's going to be, if it's anything like what Jesus is going to experience, then they will be abused for doing the right thing. Now we see in chapter 2, in the midst of chapter 2, how Jesus is being chastised for eating with the riffraff, right? Tax collectors and sinners, and messing with Sabbath law. And we see now this distrust, a deep distrust of God's work in the world at this moment. They see it and they think it is demonic. Even Jesus' own family think he is crazy or possessed. This is so much like what we see in Samuel. About 1,000 years before Jesus, the people break God's heart again in perhaps the cruelest way possible. And they don't even know they've done it. All they've said is that they want a king, right? How can that be cruel? Because that request undoes everything God has been doing with them. Centuries of work with these people, for these people, in spite of these people. And what they unknowingly do is reject God's very mission. In asking for a king to have what everyone else has, they are not only saying that God is not enough, but that they don't want God as their king. He's too distant. They want a person, tangible, with them to be their king here. So this makes this chapter from Samuel 8, to use Daniel Kirk's phrase, the anti-Exodus text. As we remember, the story of Exodus, as we know, is when God liberated the people from slavery in Egypt. But God's action, his direct action with bringing these people out of earthly rule, right, of this human king who oppressed and brutalized the people, preventing them from being with God. He was a human obstacle to their very intimacy with God. So God got rid of the problem. And so God could become their king again. So they could be the blessed community again. To want a king is to reject that liberation. To reject that liberation is to reject the kingship of God, and therefore to reject God. So God warns them through Samuel of what having an earthly king means to them, what it's going to mean: earthly oppression and divine estrangement. Like when they were under Pharaoh. Right? And this comes not because God is mad at them, but because when lives are on the line, they don't trust God. This rejection of God is very much the stuff of what Jesus speaks to in Mark. That they're rejecting the spirit of God's very work and mission with humanity. When I was 18, I drifted away from the church. I didn't quit so much as I stopped going and participating and being in church. And I hardly went for over 2 years. I didn't reject God or even really the church. I just didn't want this, like what we do, because I didn't feel as if this wanted me. Many around us are feeling a similar rejection. Or they go further than I did and reject the church completely. But most of these don't reject God so much as reject the intermediaries, the obstacles to God. They see in the church that earthly kingship, that rejection of Jesus, as crazy and demonic. For many, they don't see God at work in the church at all, or in the lives of the Christians who populate it. That Jesus' own family doesn't believe him, that they try to dismiss him, is tragic, certainly, but telling. It isn't some historical footnote in the life of an earthly Jesus, but the warning to these new apostles, these 12 who have been called to do this very work, that rejection hurts, and it hits close to home. Jesus offers a sign of grace and hope to his followers, however. It isn't all bad and menacing. In fact, it is extremely generous. Jesus describes God's grace as forgiving everything. Everything. The only one who can't be forgiven is the one who refuses to be forgiven. Like the one who wants Pharaoh or Saul rather than God. The one who wants power and wealth and oppression to order our society rather than the blessed community. The one who doesn't want the kingdom to come at all because they don't very much mind that people are suffering. Suffer oppression rather than suffer the burden and responsibility of the cross. In other words, the only ineligible for grace are the ones who opt out. So this story, which shows these newly called apostles what Jesus' ministry is going to be like, that it involves rejection and persecution, and even mothers and sisters and brothers will think you're absolutely crazy, that your work won't make sense to a world that continues to reject God as its king, and instead further invests in systems of oppression. That they'll call you crazy and out of your mind. They care about you, right? So they'll want to help you, right? Which means looking out for you with some professional help. Get you out of that crazy mindset. All because you reject evil and love the kingdom. Now, the next chapter that finishes this frame is a bunch of seed parables, right? Hard and dry ground, the mustard seed, and all that. Stories and teachings of rejection and blossoming faith in God and God's work in transforming the world. So our story is no different. Their problems are our problems, but their grace is also our grace. And this isn't a story of permanent pain, but a story of love and commitment to love. We don't have to commit ourselves to oppression and isolation and these things that destroy our spirit and drive away the spirit from us. We can make God more important than our country and our culture. That the love of God is more important than the like of our strangers. That the joy of grace can be felt in the discomfort of not fitting in. And I'm certain Michael Curry, Bishop of North Carolina, is right when he says that we need some crazy Christians. We have enough reasonable, logical, fair-minded, level-headed Christians. Sorry. A lot of us here are just like that. And that's great. But we have far too many legalistic and duty-bound faithful, right? Who could really use a bit more faith before we really start considering them full of it. We have plenty of these kind of Christians. We have far too few creative and chaotic and whimsical and compassionate, shouting hallelujah, giving up their lives and carrying the cross Christians. Far too few artists painting and sculpting and weaving and sewing and singing and writing God's dream for the kingdom and making it known everywhere. If the world doesn't think we're crazy, then we're doing something wrong. And the people seeking God will come anyway. They'll come, in fact, because there is a sign that God is here. There is a sign, and that's that we're a little crazy. So let's make sure they'll find that Christ is here and that he's the reason we're a little crazy.